Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
DeGrom winds, delivers, first pitch hit in the air to deep right field. Down the line toward the corner. This one may get out of here. It is gone. Goodbye. Off the facing of the upper deck and lands back on the playing field. Bang, zoom goes Adam Eaton on the first pitch he sees.
What's up, Nats fans? Bob Trossett inside our NBC Sports Washington podcast studios on the Racing Presidents, joined by Chase Hughes. And Chase, well, welcome in. We got plenty to talk about today. We'll have Barry Svalluga at the on the back end of this, and we're looking forward to certainly talking to the longtime columnist at the Washington Post. But first, Chase, something that is absolutely essential to this team is re-signing Anthony Rendon. This week, there's been all sorts of swirling going around. Whether or not it's too late, then Rizzo comes out and says, no, this is an absolute priority. Now the article from MLB.com comes out. Mark Feinsand is talking about six teams that could potentially be a fit for Rendon. What is your takeaway from the article?
Well, a few takeaways. First of all, some of these teams make sense. One of them does not. The Philadelphia Phillies. I don't think that's happening. Beyond the obvious of how awful it would be to see Bryce Harper and Anthony Rendon reunite in a Phillies uniform, I don't think the Phillies have the prospects. One of the things that stood out to me when Bryce Harper signed there and I was looking at how good they could be for a long time, obviously they're good this year, but they had no top 50 prospects before this season. But the Phillies are going to be a team that's going to be linked to a lot of the top names in the trade market just because of where they are and how aggressive they've been in the past. Madison Bumgarner's another name to watch. USA Today's Bob Nightingale, who's been on this show, wrote an article about the top names to watch, and Rendon was number two behind Madison Bumgarner. Marcus Stroman of the Toronto Blue Jays is another guy to watch, and also Sean Doolittle of the Nationals. And I don't know if Anthony Rendon would be traded, but I do think the Nationals have to have learned a lesson from last summer when they held on to Bryce Harper, got nothing for him, and ended up seeing him leave in free agency. Now, we've covered extensively the differences between those guys and the differences between their negotiations. Anthony Rendon has no problem talking about this. He has no problem talking to the team midseason, but a deal has yet to be done. I think once we get to July 1st, if they're still around 10 games under 500, then the Nationals have to consider being sellers, because I think it's a difference 2 years in a row disappointing than one, because 1 year's an aberration. This might be a extended decline of this team, and Rendon would highlight that those examples. So would Sean Doolittle, but they've also got some other guys that are either about to hit free agency after this year, like Howie Kendrick or Brian Dozier, but also some guys with team-friendly contracts and options after this season, like Matt Adams, Sean Doolittle, like I said, Yan Gomes, Adam Eaton, also Trevor Rosenthal. If one of these, if he can start pitching better, that's a name to watch. But Anthony Rendon is clearly the name that tops that list. And some of the other teams that Mark Feinsand listed are the Yankees, Indians, Brewers, Pirates, and Tampa Bay Rays.
He turns 29 in June. He's had a 17-game hitting streak this season already. Then he went on the IL. So obviously, I think we all thought that streak had a chance to continue, whether if it weren't for that hit-by-pitch down in Miami. When you take a look at those six teams, one in the division, obviously, with the Phillies.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Right. We don't like that. But you look at these other teams, they're some of the more aggressive historically, obviously, especially the Yankees. Could you honestly see him going to New York?
I think it would be a bad fit for him media-wise, because he's very media-shy.
He wouldn't fit there.
No, he wouldn't fit there. And it's to the point where sometimes he could be kind of contentious with the media if he's not, you know, if you catch him on the wrong day. I think it would be a bad fit in that regard. But certainly the Nationals, I think, could get a lot for Anthony Rendon if they wanted to trade him. And you look at how their cupboard's kind of bare when it comes to pitching prospects. You have to at least think it. And Mike Rizzo's always said that he'll pick up the phone and listen to an offer for any player. But it still seems like it would behoove them to get a deal done long term. And I believe Mike Rizzo when he says they really want to, because Anthony Rendon is such a valuable player defensively and offensively. And he's theoretically not going to cost as much as a Bryce Harper or Manny Machado did. So I still think that the Nationals re-sign him, but the longer that they play like this, the more that they have to consider being sellers and more aggressive sellers than they were last season.
Yeah, and it's the fan base, us, everyone surrounding this team will only get more and more restless as a deja vu type of feeling comes into play just a year removed from Bryce Harper. All right, what about, we are looking past the Mets series because for a lot of reasons, it wasn't one to remember.
Well, aside from the off-the-field stuff with Todd Frazier and Adam Eaton.
And that's where we're going right now. What is the deal? Because it stems back to their time as teammates with the Chicago White Sox. Then you saw on NBC Sports Chicago, Ozzie Guillen coming in after Adam Eaton.
I can say one thing about it. Eaton, nobody liked you in the White Sox uniform in the clubhouse, okay? That's what
that's
I
real.
Know.
That's being real.
I just being honest.
That is some real talk right there.
Basically coming right after him that he wasn't liked in that clubhouse. You've been on the beat for a while with the Nats and covered baseball. What do you make of this whole saga?
Well, first of all, that was extremely unusual. A manager on television, NBC Sports Chicago, like you said, saying no one liked you in the clubhouse when I coached the team. I mean, that to me is just amazing. It's crazy, even for Ozzie Guillen, who's known to speak his mind, for a manager to speak for the team and say that no one liked you is just incredible to me. I loved it because you're talking about a late May series between, two division rivals, but it spiced things up. And it proved that there is some trash talking in baseball. You know, I did an extensive article a few years ago about trash talking in all the major sports. Football happens all the time, basketball all the time, hockey all the time. But it doesn't happen in baseball. As I heard from Max Scherzer and Trey Turner and Bryce Harper, they said that, you know, there's not as many one-on-one matchups. There's pitchers and hitters, but the failure rate in baseball is so high that no one ever feels like they can just, you know, talk someone else down because everyone's failing most of the time. You know, even legends hit only 30% of the time. But the most amazing thing about all of this is the backstory because it circles back to the Washington Nationals technically because I covered the team when Adam LaRoche was their first baseman and his son Drake LaRoche was in elementary school but was homeschooled and he was around the Nationals and in their clubhouse all the time. He had a locker. He wore a Nationals jersey. He wore Nationals pants. He had cleats. He'd warm up on the field. He was basically like the 26th guy on the roster, and a lot of the players loved him for it. And the Nationals were cool with him being in the clubhouse. He then signed with the Chicago White Sox, and their front office took umbrage with the kid who was like 9 years old being in the clubhouse, and it split the team. Remember, Chris Sale like pouted about it, saying that, you know, it was very emotional about how they wanted Drake LaRoche around. Well, I had forgotten this, but Adam Eaton was one of those guys who was pro-Drake LaRoche and said that the team had lost one of their leaders about the 9-year-old son of Adam LaRoche. And apparently him and Todd Frazier had a disagreement about it that was so strong that Adam Eaton had his locker moved. They had their locker separated in the White Sox clubhouse. So the fact that it crossed back to the Nationals to me in that way is just incredible.
Amazing how it stems from that kind of, it's a pretty lighthearted thing, right? It's someone's son who obviously was beloved in that locker room. So an interesting concept, no doubt. All right, Chase, looking forward to this conversation now with Barry Svrluga, the longtime sports columnist at the Washington Post since 2003. Baseball, golf, NFL, college hoops, and football. Really interesting conversation, and we hope you enjoy it. All right, Barry, thanks for calling in and joining the Racing Presidents. Now, first question for you. If someone from outside D.C. asks you why this team, and that is the Nats, are playing so poorly, do you simply tell them the bullpen and injuries, or is there a greater problem that maybe the media is missing?
You know, I think maybe 2 weeks ago I would have said, look, they had an ill-constructed bullpen, and they took a risk-reward on Trevor Rosenthal that was much riskier than any reward, and that sent into a spiral a terrible situation at the back end of games. And then, you know, you would have had to have said, and plus, at a time, they had their 2, 3, 4, and 5 hitters, both their 5 hitters out of the lineup, and no team can really endure that for very long. But I think as we get further into this morass, it seems that something else is missing. And I don't know if you can put your finger on it. Obviously, Davey Martinez is getting a lot of heat and deservedly so. He doesn't seem to be ahead of games strategically, and he doesn't have a real presence, a leadership presence in the clubhouse. That's an issue. But if you look at this Mets series, when I think all expectations were to move forward, and instead they moved backwards, there's got to be some sort of analysis of an it factor in the clubhouse that isn't there. Almost impossible to put your finger on, but this should be too talented a bunch to just be getting rolled by a team that was in, you know, bigger crisis than they were coming into the week and now has flipped that script a little bit.
Barry, as you mentioned, obviously some of the focus is going to come on Davey Martinez, and you've covered a lot of sports. I'm curious, in a general sense, how important do you think managers are? Because I would argue they are important, but I'm not sure that in this case that, you know, 10 wins could be swung just by a manager, and some would argue that they only control the last third of a game. But in generally speaking, how much importance do you put on a manager and the job they do?
So, I mean, I think people have been trying to quantify this for a long time, right, especially as everything else in baseball becomes more and more quantifiable, and it's a really difficult thing to do. The way I kind of think of it is a baseball manager as important as an NFL head coach? And the answer there, I think, is absolutely not, because an NFL head coach is going to determine, you know, if he's an offensive guy, the offensive system that they run or the defensive system that they run, a lot of personnel and how they fit into that particular alignment and strategy and execution. Baseball managers don't have anything to do with anything like that. They are constructing a lineup that's not as important as what an NFL offense looks like. They are figuring out how to use a bullpen, which is an extremely important part of the job. And beyond that, they are a problem solver and tone setter for 162 games. I think we now know what a great tone setter Dusty Baker was over the course of 6 months. You can quibble with his in-game strategy, but he knew how to keep a team afloat, both in good times and in bad times. A manager who's a good manager has to have a presence. They have to be more part of the solution than part of the problem. And I don't think at this point, a year and change into Martinez's tenure, you can say that he's part of the solution on a daily basis or even on a month-to-month basis.
Barry, I'm curious to hear your answer to this one. It's a little bit of a loaded question, but basically, what are the chances that this team can turn it around? And I guess that definition is tricky, right? Because my answer would be, well, if there was one positive thing, it would be that Scherzer and Corbin really have been doing all they can for this team, and still you've found, in a pretty good sample size now, 50 games into this season, they still have really pitched well, but the offense has really been giving them, especially Scherzer, very little. Can this team turn it around?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, at the beginning of the week, I would have said yes, because I saw 8 games ahead against the reeling Mets and the terrible Marlins and said, you know, you win 6 of 8 here and things aren't as bad as they seemed a week ago. And then they gagged away 3 straight games to the Mets. I mean, you lose that Corbin versus Font matchup on Monday night, and the reality of the season starts to set in. The math here is going to get extremely difficult. Now, is there some, you know, kind of regression to the mean at some point? Are these guys really as good as we thought they were beforehand? And could they, you know, play winning baseball over the rest of the season? Yeah, absolutely that could happen. They do have their lineup back almost completely now, except for Zimmerman. They can feel the competitive offense, or they should be able to feel the competitive offense nightly. Obviously, the rotation is good enough to get it done. But if turning it around means making the playoffs, and that's the standard here, right? This team expects to play in October and expects to move beyond where they haven't moved beyond before, and that's into the League Championship Series and World Series. It gets very difficult to see a path when you're 11 games under 500 and only one team in the National League is worse than you, and that's the Marlins as we head into Memorial Day weekend.
Since the Nationals have gotten good, we've mostly seen a pattern of when they have a disappointing season, they are able to bounce back the next year. This year, that's not the case. How have you seen that kind of weigh on the team, maybe affect their confidence? And does it say anything about the roster and its window in the big picture?
Well, I mean, those are the big questions now. I mean, as you said, you know, since they won a division title in 2012, they've never gone back-to-back years with missing the postseason, and that's what would be happening here if they don't, you know, kind of miraculously turn things around. The clubhouse, even in down years, I think has always been buoyed by ownership and the front office's commitment to win that year since they did the big rebuild back around, you know, 08, 09 2010, there hasn't been any talk of, okay, we're going to rebuild. We've got to have a down season. That's what they're enduring now. And I think, you know, the big questions in the next month are identifying who your core is going forward and figuring out how to use the resources you have now to add to that core. Anthony Rendon is their best player. He is a free agent at the end of the year. They have said they want to re-sign him. They have not yet done so. If that's the case in July, he would bring quite a haul in return and help replenish a farm system that has been depleted by trades in the past when the Nationals, understandably, were going all in and were dealing prospects for players in hopes of moving forward in the playoffs. So Rendon is a consideration. He's only got a half year left. Sean Doolittle with a club option for $6.5 million next year is an obvious choice. And then the big question, Max Scherzer, who's got 2 years left and would be able to avoid a trade after this season because he would have 10-5 rights. It seems crazy to consider trading Scherzer, but I think those are the big questions that this team has to ask of itself right now, because this season is spiraling a little bit out of control. And in order to get back to the point where the Major League clubhouse feels like it's in position to win each and every spring, they're going to have to add, young, controllable prospects that gives them kind of a new core going forward.
You've painted a good picture of what it would look like if the Nationals choose to become sellers. When do you think that would happen? Do you think that they've learned a lesson from what they did last year with Bryce Harper?
Well, I think that's something that ownership probably learned. And I understand that Harper kind of represents more than just a homegrown player. He was, in a lot of ways, the face of what they accomplished beginning in 2012 when he came up as a rookie. So I get that there was a real emotional kind of reluctance to trade him. And Mark Lerner ultimately was the one that stepped in and stopped the trade that they had in place with Houston. He couldn't pull the trigger on it, and so Harper played out the rest of 2018 here. I think you're right about learning from that, and that applies directly to Rendon. If it becomes apparent that you're not going to be able to sign him or negotiations have broken down, what is the point of hanging on to him for the final 2 months of the season when, you know, he could bring real frontline prospects or established major league players in return for a contender? I think it'd be crazy if they hadn't learned from the Harper situation. And I also think that they should be engaged in these talks on the early side. The trade deadline isn't until July 31st, but they should have a sense of the market and a sense of the teams that are looking to add a third baseman or a left-handed reliever / closer or a frontline starter so that they're maximizing their haul when they finally do pull the trigger.
All right, Barry, narrow it down for us. What's the one loss this season that just tipped it over the edge for you? Was it Wednesday with Doolittle giving up that eighth inning blast and then just all unraveling from there? Was it maybe a Friday night Pittsburgh when Corbin's gem was wasted? Was it the walk-off infield single from Tuesday night in New York? What are you pinpointing?
So I go Monday and Tuesday in New York. I mean, if you think of the situation when they came in there, they had just played a competitive series with the Cubs, who are playing about as good a baseball as any team in the National League right now. Yes, they lost the Sunday night game 6-5, but they came back from 6-1. Rendon kind of drove them from behind, and they had a chance late. Strasburg had pitched, you know, about his best game of the year on Saturday night for a win, and Scherzer had been very competitive on Friday night. I kind of felt like, in a weird way, they had a little bit of momentum because they had played three normal games and lost in two of them in normal fashion. And the Mets were coming off a sweep by the Marlins, had all sorts of questions about their manager, announced on Monday that Jonas Cespedes had suffered an injury at his ranch and would be out forever and ever and ever, and just seemed to be in complete mayhem, a worse situation than Washington. Go to Monday night, and Patrick Corbin is pitching against the guy that essentially was filling in for the Mets and had been acquired in a trade within the last couple weeks, really a holdover guy, and they lose that game, and they lose it without much of a peep. And then pin that with Tuesday night when you're asking in the eighth inning, Tanner Rainey, who a week ago was at Fresno, walking plenty of guys and in Fresno for a reason. You're asking him to pitch the eighth inning in a big league game, a one run big league game that your team has to win. Those two combined kind of do it for me, just because it eliminates the chance to take those eight games against struggling opponents and win six or seven of them and get yourself back in. They've been playing behind this whole season, and they continued to play behind by losing those first two games to the Mets.
So sticking in the NL East, obviously the Nats are looking up at the Phillies and the Braves. Who do you think is the better team of those two?
Man, I haven't seen the Braves this year. I know that everybody's got bullpen problems, and I know that Bryce Harper is struggling for Philly after getting off to a pretty fine start. That brings long-term questions there. I really like the depth of the Phillies lineup. I'm not crazy about their starting pitching, particularly if Aaron Nola is not the Aaron Nola of 2018. But I think the part of the frustrating thing for Nationals fans is how susceptible both of those teams seem as we get a couple months into the season. They're fine teams, and one of them will win a division title, and deservedly so. But the opportunity loss for the Nationals is significant, because if you look at what both of them have in the back end of their bullpen, if you look at what both of them have in the rotation, those are teams that the Nationals should be expected to be able to compete with and should be able to compete with, and they're swimming upstream, double digits under 500. It's still, I mean, even though we've watched it play out, it still seems kind of inconceivable to me that things have gone this badly this soon.
Barry, thanks for your time and insight. Hopefully next time we chat with you, it's about some miraculous comeback here in D.C.
We'll see. I appreciate it, guys.
Fly ball out to right field. Playable for Harper. And that'll do it for the Cubs here in the sixth inning. And Harper just threw that one onto the rooftop behind Wrigley Field. 1-0 Cubs as we go to the seventh.
You know, I found it funny, Chase, that Barry, he wanted to talk about Philadelphia, and obviously we talk about the depth and whatnot. You know, when Bryce is on the road, not exactly the faintest of hearts for that guy. Wrigley Field gave him a nice little tossing, huh?
That was strange. He gets it all the time from fans. Like, I've written about some of the things he's heard from fans, and to crack like that, to snap like that, was really surprising. I think it goes to show how much he's been struggling, but also the thing I took away from it, everyone's like, oh, he got back at Cubs fans in the perfect way. He threw a baseball, like, into traffic, right? Yeah. He threw it out of the stadium. Outside of the stadium is not water. It's North Sheffield Avenue, I believe, in Chicago. And it's like there's that urban legend, and it is an urban legend. If you drop a penny from the top of the Empire State Building, it could kill someone. It actually can't. They debunked that on Mythbusters.
Oh, really?
Which I didn't know.
I've always wondered that.
But a baseball could hurt someone.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't need to drop from the Empire State Building. So I'm surprised he didn't get fined or maybe even suspended for that, because that's a dangerous move.
You do wonder, though, is it wear and tear because of his play or lack thereof? Or is it actually because he can't take the abuse anymore, because he's getting it pretty much at every road venue?
Well, also worth noting, yeah, he gets it from everywhere, but also worth noting, he's actually been playing pretty well. I just looked at his numbers today. He's hitting 300 in his last eight games, so he's kind of turning things around. But Wrigley, Chicago fans let him have it, and he snapped.
Yeah, and that middle patch was tough. He was striking out quite a bit, so he's launched a few in the last couple. So anyway, well, Chase, that'll just about do it for this episode. Before we sign off here, check out the Wizards Talk podcast dropping on Friday morning with Elena Deladon of the Mystics, obviously coming off a pretty solid season and a campaign. She and Natasha Cloud and the rest of the gals trying to get it done this year in the WNBA. So, for my guy Chase Hughes, I'm Bob Trossett signing off from another edition of the Racing Presidents. We'll be back with you all week long and into the weekend. Spend part of your Memorial Day weekend with us right here at NBC Sports Washington.